Blog Talk Radio.
Between 7:30 and 9:20, and we hope that you join us at times in and out for some very wonderful people. As always, Roy's in Tampa, Florida. Roger Hendler is in Atlanta for the last few weeks before he comes back to Philadelphia. Our executive producer, Frank Carroll, is at the controls. We hope you all had a wonderful, wonderful Memorial Day weekend, but more importantly, a safe weekend with not too much drinking. Frank?
Yeah, Don, tonight's program is dedicated. Each and every one of our programs are dedicated either before or after the show to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Tonight's program is dedicated to the real reason for Memorial Day, for those Gold Star families who lost a family member during the World Wars or sometime during the Korean or Vietnam conflict. These people have given the ultimate sacrifice that we can never, ever repay. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, freedom is not free. And these people have died to try to help us keep this country as free and our living as easy as possible. So tonight, we dedicate this program to those who have gone before us, those who will come after us, and to the Gold Stars family who have lost a member.
Thank you very much, Amen. Frank. Obviously, a very sincere time around Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people look at it as a vacation, and it is a vacation, but it's a very, very important day in the lives of the United States of America. Let's start off tonight's program on the baseball front. We're passing the quarter pole right now. We really haven't spent a lot of time talking about baseball on the show because so many other things have been going on in the meantime. But, Roy, let's start off in the American League East. Tampa Bay got off to the great start, still playing extremely well. Baltimore, the surprise of the American League East, no question about it, in second place. The Yankees, after their win last night out in Seattle, are slowly climbing up. They're right there in third. But some of your observations about the American League East to start with.
Yeah, you know, look, it's obviously, once again, as it has been for quite some time now, really, the best division in baseball, and the best just seems to get better. I mean, I think the Yankees are better now than they were a year ago, 2 years ago, and yet they're just, you know, doing everything they can to keep pace with Tampa, which is not unexpected, but they're doing everything they can just to keep pace with Baltimore, which I think is a little bit unexpected. You know, if you paid attention to Baltimore a year ago, you could see that this was a team on the rise, that they were coming. Had some nice pitching that, you know, and they certainly had some bats that, you know, you had to respect. But I don't think anyone really expected them to rise as quickly and be as strong as they are. You know, if it weren't for the Rays and the incredible start that they got off to, the Orioles would be the talk of baseball right now. I mean, they would be, just, you know, probably more so than the Rays. I mean, you really have to be a bit of a baseball diehard to really – I mean, everybody knows that the Rays are playing well, but they don't get talked about as much as other teams do just because of the, you know, the market they're in. They get a little bit of the short shrift there. But at the end of the day, you know, Baltimore, I think, would have certainly been – the darling of baseball fans and analysts everywhere, because they're just playing incredibly well. Now, today was a tough day for them. They gave up a lot of runs, a lot of hits. Couldn't seem to get Josh Naylor out, but, you know, they're not the first people to struggle with that. But at the end of the day, they are just an incredible team that's really, really, you know, caught fire early on this year and making it very interesting in an AL East that is, as always, or seems to always be, exceptionally good. I mean, when you've got Boston at the bottom, you know, two games over 500 and 9.5 games out of first, that tells you how good, just how good that that division is. Toronto is another team that I think probably underachieving at this point, not playing at the level they can, but any one of those teams could still win that division, and boy, won't surprise me at all if we see three teams in that division in the playoffs.
Roy, as we look down the line, Roger, go over to the Central. Really not too much to talk about in the Central Division. It's sort of a combination of teams that win and lose, win and lose. Minnesota's holding on at the top at the moment. Detroit, surprisingly, is in second spot, but there's not really any dominant team in the Central Division that you're afraid to play?
No, there isn't. And when we get to the NL East, there's some interesting information that is developed that I didn't even realize. So I'll wait on that. But you're right. There's several divisions in baseball that are strong, and the American League East, obviously, and the West, the NL West, you know, should be and is to an extent. But, you know, it's been interesting. As you said, Don, we're at the quarter pole, and it's been very interesting about the performers and non-performers throughout the major leagues, starting with Trey Turner.
Roy, we can go to the American League West, where there's a lot of interest. Really surprised Bochy. What a job he's done in Texas. They're in first place at the moment. Houston is struggling a little bit under Dusty. They haven't come out of the gate real strong. Los Angeles has two of the best players in the major leagues, two of the best players in the American League, but they just can't consistently win.
Yeah, you're right. And look, you know, I thought for a long time, I like what Texas has been doing. Not afraid to spend money. You know, they built up the middle with Marcus Semien and then Corey Seager. They've got a really nice catcher. If you don't pay much attention to the game, you don't know who Jonah Heim is, but if you do, you do. And, you know, they got, look, the outfield it could be one of the best in baseball, potentially. Adelis Garcia, another guy that given up by the Cardinals. Boy, that's a whole other story, is some of the great players that the Cardinals have given up who have turned into stars around baseball. Adelis Garcia is certainly one of them in Texas. Randy Arozarena is another one in Tampa Bay. But, yeah, the West is a very interesting division there. I mean, look, I think Houston is going to be fine going ahead. I mean, the pitching is always strong. They got more pitching, it seems, than anybody else. Very deep in the starting rotation there. They're really just now getting Jose Altuve back. Jeremy Pena hasn't played at the level I think they expected of him. So, you know, they've been scuffling just a little bit for them. Not a whole lot. I mean, they are 10 games over 500, but Texas has been a little bit better. And you know what? LA is just LA. It just seems like forever. They've had arguably the best player in baseball for a long time. Now they got two of the three best players in baseball, and they still can't seem to get over the hump. I mean, yeah, they're over 500, but they're really a kind of a 500 ball club, and it just makes you wonder what's happening there. And you know, I think there's one disappointing team in that division, and that's Seattle. That division had the potential, with the exception of Oakland, obviously, which I don't think Oakland knows what it's doing, but you know, that division had the potential to be just as strong as the AL East, and I think at the end of the day, it still could be. Seattle is a team you got to watch for. They've got a lot of good young talent there, some good young pitching. If the bullpen can get a little bit stronger, if they can make a move there, I think you'll see a couple of teams obviously go deep into the playoffs in that group too. So like that division a lot. Very intriguing division, especially now that Texas is finally playing up to the abilities that it should be playing up to. Look, I like, as I said at the beginning, I like what they've done, you know, personnel-wise, but I still think maybe the best move that they've made is getting Bruce Bochy. I mean, there's certain guys who just seem to have a knack for turning teams into winners, no matter what the talent level is, and Bruce Bochy's one of them.
Roger, we're going to get to your bailiwick. The Philadelphia Phillies lost 2-0 last night in a very unusual game. Watch that one as well as the Seattle Yankee game. Seattle, just a terrible team in the American League West. It was awful. But anyway, let's get to the National League East, because the Philadelphia Phillies are really struggling. They're leading 1-0 right now in the third inning. A lot of complaints last night. Harper sat out in a game that they were only behind 1-0 and didn't get an opportunity to play. But I know you've been waiting for the Phils, Roger, so the National League East, go to it.
Well, I just think the Braves are the elite in the NL East, and I did watch that game last night on TBS, and I was really surprised to hear that I think in Major League Baseball, the Mets have the oldest average age in baseball. With the money they spent, I guess it shows that their minor league system isn't that good right now. Sosa just hit the home run that went over the home run line on the left field stands where they have that fence at Citi Field. So, but last night, Sager, the pitcher for the Mets, was from Japan, was just outstanding. And, you know, the thing I can't
figure out is, he struck out 9 last night.
Oh,
didn't walk anybody.
Yeah, he looked fantastic, and he had a few ups and downs coming along. But if you look at the Japanese players that have come here, when we were all young, they always felt the Japanese players were too small to play here. Well, that's not true anymore. And I don't understand why more players aren't recruited from Japan. I really don't, because everyone that I've seen produces.
Well,
the other
I'll tell
thing
you
is,
why.
Before we leave the East, Roger, Atlanta, you're in Atlanta and have been for the last 6 or 7 years. Atlanta is picking up where they left off. Looks like they're going to roll right back to another National League championship.
Well, they are, Don, and they have the pitching. They're young. What we were worried about, what happens at shortstop with the loss of Dansby Swanson. What do they have? Acia, who is young and coming in and just did a great job. They are by far, in my opinion, the best team in the NL East and one of the best in baseball.
We go back to you, Roy, in the Central. Pittsburgh, again, like Baltimore, a little bit of a surprise, not playing as well as Baltimore is, but at the same time, they're still making their presence felt in the Central Division, Milwaukee on top. But that, again, is not a dominant division, and yet you're a Chicago man, and every time they start to get a little streak going, they turn around and go the other way.
Yeah, it has kind of been that way, although they're coming off of, you know, they've had, look, they had a nice series against Tampa Bay, won the first two, allowed only about 8 hits in the whole first two games, and then today was a nail-biter right down to the end and back and forth a little bit. And I think the Cubs are starting to play a little bit better baseball, but I don't think anybody really fears anyone in the NL Central right now. I don't think anybody thinks Pittsburgh is going to be there at the end of the day. I think most people believe that it's going to be Milwaukee and that St. Louis will at some point kind of catch fire. But St. Louis has done some interesting things too. You know, they had Jordan Walker up to start the year, the celebrated rookie, and who certainly looked like he was ready to play regularly at this level. And next thing you know, he's down in the minor leagues. And, you know, they've just had a lot of issues. I mean, they took the catching duties away from Wilson Contreras, who they spent a lot of money to take away from Chicago. Then they gave it back to him. So there's a lot of things going on in St. Louis that are very – very interesting. It's like it's just not sure if anybody knows who's really running the show there, and you know what they're trying to achieve. But I think eventually they'll be a team. But that's a division for the taking. Anybody could take it. I mean, if Pittsburgh can figure out a way to kind of get back on beam, they're a little bit below 500 over the last 20 or so. I think anybody could have that division. But again, I think come playoff time, unless somebody makes some big moves. I don't think anybody's going to really fear anyone in that division. So it's clearly the weakest division in baseball, and it's kind of been that way for a while now, and it continues this year, especially when you got the Cardinals in last place.
Yeah, the real surprise, the Cardinals, they've always been a dominant team, always been right there throughout the course of the season, and this year just mired somewhere close to the bottom right now, in the bottom. Roger, we go to the West, and I don't know what to say. The Dodgers just keep winning and winning and winning. Dave's done a great job out there. San Diego spends millions of dollars in the offseason every year. Wanted to get Judge for with an unbelievable price. He finally went back to the Yankees. God bless him. But how can you figure out the West?
Well, just to get back to Roy for a minute, I think you were going to say something about the explanation on Japanese ball players recruiting, Roy.
Yeah, I was, and the issue there is pretty simple. It has to do with the fastball for both pitchers and hitters. Really, the hitters are not accustomed to the average speed of the fastball in Japan is about 3 miles per hour less than what it is here in the United States. Right now, you just don't find guys throwing 96, 98 consistently. And now, you know, remember when we marveled at Aroldis Chapman throwing 100 miles an hour?
Yes.
Now you got 5 or 6 or 8 guys in the major leagues throwing 100 miles an hour. It's not all that unusual anymore. It's still a bit of a marvel, but it's not that unusual. Not every team's got one, but there's 5 or 6 guys scattered out there throughout baseball. And what happens with the hitters from Japan is that they struggle primarily to keep pace with the fastball. So that's number one. Number two, it's the same thing. You know, if hitters can adjust easily to 92 miles an hour, and that's what you're getting from Japanese pitchers, well, that's going to be easy for hitters to adjust to. And so those mistakes can really be magnified into big problems for pitchers if they don't have an out pitch. I mean, what you've seen Shohei Ohtani do is revolutionize the game. He's come up with this pitch called the sweeper. which to me is like a kind of, it's kind of a, just a longer, less, more exaggerated slider, kind of sweeps across the plate, as opposed to, you know, bending off sharply, down and in, or down and away if you're a right-handed batter. And he's had to do that because, you know, he doesn't necessarily throw 98 miles an hour. So he's come up with that pitch. And but a lot of other pitchers, you know, aren't capable of doing that. If they can be, if they can come up with a specific pitch, it's going to work out for him. And I think if you look back at the history of Japanese pitchers, you know, from Hideo Nomo on, those guys always had the ones who we know, the names we know, the pitchers who have been successful. They had a special pitch. They had something a little bit different. It wasn't just a, you know, fastball, slider, curveball, changeup mix. They had something a little bit different that that hitters had a hard time adjusting to. And the hitters, you know, Hideki Matsui comes to mind, obviously. Seiya Suzuki with the Cubs right now, who's hitting very well. You know, he chalks everything up to the fact that he spent an entire offseason this past year developing more strength so that he could catch up to the fastball here in Major League Baseball. And after hitting, you know, about 250 a year ago without a lot of power, he's put on some weight, put on some added some muscle, and tried to adjust to the speed of the game here. So it's really the speed of the game more than anything, the speed of that fastball on both sides, both ends, that is the difference maker. And that's why only a handful of the Japanese players make it here and can really thrive at a very high level. Again, we've seen a lot of those guys come through, but I think more and more you're going to, as they figure this out, you'll see those players make it more. But up till now, that's been the issue, guys.
Roger, we saw that last night in the Mets game because what we saw was a forkball, Elroy face forkball. They you call it the ghost pitch. They can call it anything they want, but it's really the relative. It's a forkball, and they floated enough of it last night in slow motion, and they showed his grip on the ball and everything else going along with it. And he averaged walking seven a game because his pitches are mostly out of the strike zone. The Phillies didn't take advantage of that last night and didn't get one walk. Here's a pitcher that averages seven walks a game, and they don't get one walk. And 90% of the balls that they struck out on weren't even close to the strike zone. So, yes, Roy's right. It's a trick pitch, but it's really nothing more than Elroy faced his forkball. That's all.
Well, they call it, the ghost pitch, right?
They call it a ghost pitch.
Ghost pitch, yeah.
Because it's like the sweeper. They can call all his pitches anything they want to, but they're all the same.
Yeah. Well, the Mets just took a 2-1 lead because Nola walked Vogelbach, and then there was a home run. But, you know, when you were talking about the Dodgers, they may be good on the field, but I'll tell you, they have created a PR nightmare. And, I mean, it is just the beginning, I think, of a real problem for them where they basically were very came out with a lot of comedy and critical of the Catholic Church. And with the Catholic population in L.A., in the L.A. region, and especially with, you know, the Latino community, I'll tell you, I have no idea what goes through some of these companies and now the Dodgers, what goes through their thought process. I mean, sheer stupidity. Target, Budweiser, and now the Dodgers. It makes no sense to me.
But, well, you can also put Chick-fil-A on there, too, because they just did it today or yesterday. They're challenging their market as well. And the other thing is that with digestive, people haven't had a chance to read Richie Allen's book. Richie, of course, played for the Dodgers for 2 years. And a big part, not only of his biography, which is a separate book, but a young fellow from Villanova, or law school, wrote a very, very incisive book on Dick Allen and his procedures through Major League Baseball. And, of course, as you know, Roger, this weekend, if things turn around, and Roy the same way, a guy that was run out of town on a rail in Philadelphia, and the biggest weekend for them this weekend is having a Dick Allen bobblehead doll. Roy, you explain it to me.
tell you what, Dick Allen was obviously a very controversial player in his day. Played for a lot of teams, Dodgers, White Sox, Phillies. He got bounced around a lot. A very disgruntled player. Had a reason to be disgruntled, I think. Maybe highly understood, misunderstood as a player. I'd love to read that. That biography, because I have my greatest memory of Dick Allen. A couple of them, actually. I remember when he wrote "Boo" in front of him in the
right.
dirt in Philadelphia. I remember when he was with the White Sox. You know, he was one of the first guys to start wearing a batting helmet in the field because he was afraid people were going to throw batteries and soda pop at him. And you know,
they explain that in the book, and he actually started that in the minor leagues. People didn't remember that he did. He wore the helmet in the minor leagues. The reason he wore the helmet was that he felt that taking his cap off and putting it in his pocket or leaving it on the bench got crushed, and he didn't like to wear a hat, a baseball cap that was crushed. So he always wore the helmet over the top of the baseball hat so that, therefore, it wouldn't be crushed and would always look fresh and new. That was his explanation, other than what happened later on, as this book really details at great length and also talks a great deal about his 2 years with the Los Angeles Dodgers and exactly what Roger is talking about. He talks about their PR department from the president and owner right on down when O'Malley's owned the team and how they went about it and Camp Panis and all that, which a lot of it I had not read before. So I'd recommend it to anybody if you have a chance to read it. It's Dick Allen, and it's a terrific, terrific book. But anyway, Roy, that's going to conclude our first half hour. A lot of baseball, but thank you very, very much. Always a pleasure.
Pleasure's mine, guys.
Have a great
always,
week.
Always. Thanks, guys.
Hey,
same
hey,
to you.
Don,
have a great week. Take care now.
Don, before we go any further, I just wanted to say, since you brought up Dick Allen, I want to talk to Dan because he's friends with Dick Allen's son. And we can have him on to give some insight. I've met him. Because he was at the Sports Writers, and the reason for the bobblehead is that Dick is, now had his number retired and is in the Phillies Wall of Fame. And, of course, the Phillies have been really putting a lot of emphasis on him going into Cooperstown, and he should be a long time ago.
Well, unfortunately, that didn't happen the last time. You missed by one vote. And we'll get to that, as I said. Maybe we'll get the author of the book on, because I'll tell you, it's a terrific capitulation of Richie's career all the way from his days in high school all the way through till he finally retired. But anyway, let's get back to Steve Kinsella right now, a baseball historian. And if anybody knows about baseball, it's Dick Allen. First of all, Steve, welcome back to the program and some of your thoughts.
Dick Allen was great, just going, he's not part of my generation, being a 53-year-old male, I didn't see him too much. And the limited time that I did know about him, it was later in his career, I would get his baseball card and not be too excited about it. But, as you get older and you start reading more, and you see, I believe he was the MVP with the White Sox and was an all-star game, I think, 6 or 7 times. And you think of guys from that era that starred in both the American League and National League. You got Frank Robinson, who everybody can point to immediately, but then you got Dick Allen right up there, who was successful in both leagues. A lot of young people wouldn't know what that means these days, to be a star in each league. But when you didn't have free agency and you didn't have a lot of exposure and ability to move, not a lot of guys had a chance to jump from one league to the other in mid-career and had that kind of success.
Well, that was the unfortunate part about it, because it was really almost the entire career of Dick Allen. Free agency was not a possibility. They do a tremendous job of detailing all the factors involved in what happened with Dick and his negotiations and all the trading. In fact, as you mentioned, he was traded from the Dodgers by Al Campanis, so when he got to the White Sox, became the most valuable player that year. And he just did so many great things. Not to be in the Hall of Fame is really a shame. But let's get back, Steve, to the American League East, because we talked a little bit about it in the first half hour. The Baltimore Orioles right now, I guess, have to be as big a surprise as anyone, and a welcome surprise to Baltimoreans because, you know, they're baseball people.
Yeah, Baltimore, you know, it's hard to buy into them because we don't know them. You know, the names on the back of the uniform, what we go through down here in Tampa Bay really aren't that well known. But, you know, one of the things I was doing over the winter was writing up a list of big gambles. You know, Tampa Bay not going out and getting a left-handed power bat or adding anything really to the offense was a big gamble. The Dodgers not spending big in free agency, arguably the best the most expensive free agent they got was Noah Syndergaard, who's been a shell of himself. And, you know, they're still in first place in the National League West, even though Justin Turner is playing in Los Angeles and Trey Turner is no longer playing. He's over in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And then you got the Baltimore Orioles, who also took on a big gamble. And their big gamble was not really adding a lot to the pitching staff. We see the kids coming up on the offensive side of the ball. We see the Cedric Mullins and the Anthony Santanders, you know, grabbing hold of being everyday players, you know, in the last couple of years. But then you've got Adley Rutschman, who's, you know, burst onto the scene. And he's been great. You got Gunnar Henderson coming up. But when you sit there, you look to the pitching sphere, and then they add Kyle Gibson. You know, they hoped that Grayson Rodriguez who could come along, and he didn't. And you would think, based on the additions that they made to the pitching staff, specifically the starting staff, and now John Means is not returning when they thought. I thought that was a big gamble to not put more money into the pitching side. And here we are 2 months into the season, and as of yet, the pitching hasn't cracked. Started to crack a little bit in the series with the Guardians. But we'll see moving forward. I think that, you know, the big gamble they made was simply not putting enough into the pitching side. And so far it hasn't cost them. What a wonderful month they had. Overall, you know, stopping the Rays from pulling away, taking 2 out of 3 from the Rays and just playing fantastic ball. It really was a good series, a good month for them, a good start to the season.
Roger.
Hey, Steve, question. What has happened to Trey Turner and his awful performance for the Eagles? No better way to describe it. Total disaster, in my opinion.
Well, I think we can just go back, you know, for a Philadelphia person, you can go back to the Bryce Harper experience, the first 60 games that he was there, and he admitted to pushing as hard as he could to justify the money they had spent and to fit in. As a matter of fact, I think it was JT Realmuto who pulled him aside and just had a nice long talk with him and a few other guys. And I think after about the 2-month, 3-month mark of Bryce Harper's beginning in Philadelphia, he finally relaxed and settled in and just let the talent surface. I think the second half of that first year, he was very good. I think I had predicted in my pre-2020 that he was going to win the MVP of course, that season was truncated, and then of course he's been a star with the Phillies since. So anytime a guy moves from one organization to another with a big contract, it doesn't always take off right away, and you can hope that the issue is just putting too much pressure on yourself, and maybe a little sawdust on the lower part of that bat as you're gripping it, maybe just. Mentally you're not giving yourself your normal routine. So I'm going to hold off judgment on Trey Turner for a little while longer and see if he can just get comfortable. You know, it really doesn't help the Trey Turner experience is that the Phillies have been fighting as a team to ignite. But everybody in the National League has been failed to ignite. There's really nobody that's, put their foot on the gas and really said, wow, that's the team we thought. I mean, I guess the closest we can get would be the Atlanta Braves. And maybe the Dodgers, but I just mentioned the Dodgers, they gamble and nobody knew what they were going to be with the young kids instead of the high-priced stars. So that's a good thing in Philadelphia. There's still time to ignite. Nobody's pulled away, and that should ease things up a little bit for Trey Turner.
Steve, opposite in contrast, how do you explain the Rays and what they do and the San Diego Padres, every year they keep spending all this money. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. They're going to challenge the Dodgers, and they aren't even close.
And what they do not.
Well, let's just remember that last year the Dodgers beat them 13 out of 18 games, and then they got to the postseason, and the Dodgers went home, and the Padres moved on.
They choked, yeah.
Well, that's, you know, this year it's 5-1, the Dodgers. I listened to all those games, and this year it's 5-1, the Dodgers. The Padres actually won the first one, and but I think it's a very good look at, you know, maybe the Mets and maybe the Padres. And sometimes when you put a bunch of stars together, it takes longer to come up with a cohesive, this is who we are and this is how we play and this is how we win. You know, you take a star like, you know, Xander Bogaerts, and you add him into the mix, and then you've got Fernando Tatis Jr. coming back. You've got Manny Machado coming back. So you're mixing in Machado, and you're mixing in with Machado and Jake Cronenworth and Trent Grisham and Juan Soto from a little bit last year. You're adding in a Xander Bogaerts. You're adding in a Matt Carpenter playing that role. You're adding in a Nelson Cruz in a different role. You know, you're trying to find what does that team do to win, you know, and they just haven't found it yet. And we have to give it time. On the other side of the coin, Joe Musgrove got hurt in spring training, and then he goes to Mexico and burns the tops of his feet real bad. That delays him. Yu Darvish hasn't been the same. Blake Snell is having his typical first 2 months of 100 pitches in 4 innings or 3 2/3 innings. And they have yet to be able to find any traction on the starting side. I think the biggest brightest spot so far is a free agent late, and that was Michael Wacha. Without him, that rotation might be in a little bit of trouble. But like the Phillies, like the Mets, like the Padres, we have to give it some time and figure out what the team is and how are they going to win and how are these stars going to settle in and blend what they can do. Who's going to speak up in the locker room? Who's not going to speak up in the locker room? And what's the message going to be? So it's a lot of fun early in the year, but we'll see in another month or two. You know, I'll be talking to you guys about what happened to the Padres. They're 20, you know, they're 18 games under 500 with that payroll or whatever we want to story is going to be.
Roger?
Yeah, they just got a home run against the Marlins. But staying with Trey Turner, Steve, I don't understand how a player, you know, how well he played in the football, you know, the World Classic, and then comes into the season and is playing as poorly as he is. I mean, it's not that he didn't have a spring training. Okay, got there late. I mean, he had the World Classic and did great. I don't get it. I'm sorry. I just don't get it.
I think you may have answered a little something right there. I'm mentioning to you how difficult it is for a guy with a new contract to step into a new locker room and get to know his teammates and get to know what he can say, what he can't say, and what he has to do to fit into the team and take the pressure off and kind of just roll with the flow. And here he comes, and he comes to spring training, and then he leaves and goes to the World Baseball Classic. And then right before the season, he comes back from the World Baseball Classic. You have to wonder possibly how valuable that time, getting to know the coaching staff, getting to know the players on the team and all that, how that all may have fit together. We won't know for a little while longer, but it is a mystery how some guys sign the big contract, arrive at their new place, and struggle mightily the first couple months. Not all of them, but some do.
Roger asked a great question, Roy Cummings, in the first half hour. You're the best statistical man I know. Maybe you have an answer for Roger's question was, why don't more Japanese players come over and play in the United States? Last night we saw the Mets game, and We saw what I call a forkballer, calling it a ghost pitch. They're all the same to me.
Yeah,
some of your thoughts about not only the pitchers but the everyday players making that transition.
Well, most of them try after their 8 years or so. Remember, the contracts are different. I mean, if you could leave in your prime, you know, more guys would come over. You know, if you can, you know, let's say you're 24 years old and you could be posted and make a ton of money and come over, that'd be great, but you can't. You know, you have to start early and be a rare species that starts early and gets to the point where you could be posted after a certain number of years of your career. And a lot of guys go through, you know, they go through a process where, you know, the team decides and the player both decide whether it's worth it to make the jump. You know, some guys are told that your value will be more in Japan at this point than it would be in jumping to the States. The guys that do make the jump are highly coveted guys. You know, it's kind of like the similar to like your first round of your NFL draft, your top. You know, the guys that come over, the interest in them peaks, you know, 3-4 years before they actually come over. Everybody was waiting for Ohtani to come over, you know. You know, and then you take a look at the guy Boston signed and the guy the Cubs signed, Seisuke, and I'm drawing a blank on the Boston guy.
And the Mets pitcher.
And the Mets pitcher and stuff like that. These guys have been scouted, and Major League Baseball was waiting for their posting. It really wasn't a question because 3 years, 4 years before they posted, everybody was waiting on them. There's more players available. It's just not worth it for MLB to pay the posting fee or for the player to come over when there's not the pot of gold relative to what they could make in Japan.
Right.
But there is great talent over there.
Roger?
Can they make that much in Japan, Steve?
Yeah. Yeah. They make good money over in Japan. You know, they don't make the kind of money you make in the United States. But look, you could be a good reliever in Japan and come over here and maybe make 1.2 to 1.5 million at the start, you know, and hope you can increase on that. But there's not a lot of there's not like a great divide between like what a team has in their system and what can come over from Japan. But they do identify the ones that are eligible to come over. Unfortunately, a lot of them are a little bit older. And it just, you know, it doesn't work. But the guys that are younger and Major League Baseball identifies them, it's not like there's a huge talent pool sitting over there that, you know, is not being offered come over. I mean, scouts
up next,
are good. What's that?
What was that, Don? Well, maybe the thing that are they obligated to play in Japan, Steve? And that's why it's later when they do come and the interest is later.
Yeah. You can't go from Japan to the major leagues like as a high school kid. You know, you basically have to do your time in Japan. I mean, it's quite a long commitment before you can come over, and I'm not sure the exact. Year 7, 8, whatever it is, and that 7 or 8 is similar to the major league service time to become a free agent, where when you're playing in the Japanese minor league system, so to speak, that doesn't count. That's not part of your service time. You have to get up to the first you have to get to the Japanese league, then you have to do your, you know, basically fulfill your contract and obligations there, and then the team can make you eligible. The kid from the World Baseball Classic, and forgive me if I can't recall his name right now, the pitcher for Japan, he's got, I think, 2 more years, and then he'll be posted, and he'll only be about 26 or 27, I believe, and that's the next jewel coming over from Japan. That's the next big guy.
Okay. That's interesting.
Well, Steve, we jumped around a little bit, but thank you very, very much. Always a pleasure. I want to talk about Steve Bochy and get some of your thoughts on what he's been able to do with the Rangers, and we'll do that next time. Thank you very, very much. Just always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you.
Always
gentlemen,
thanks
Steve
for having me.
Steve. Thank
well,
you
we're
so going
to switch to women's golf right now. We haven't talked much about the LPGA. I know things are going on out there. Jack Nicklaus this weekend as well. But, Frank, you've got a very good guest coming up next from the LPGA, and how about Roberta? Give us a little information.
Yeah, Roberta, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch about how you've come to this point?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for
having
me.
Hello there.
Nice to talk to somebody new, Roberta.
That's awesome. Thank you for having me. I got my LPGA card last year through qualifying school. So I've been playing on the LPGA this year after playing on the Epson Tour for 3.5 years before then. So that has been my path for the most part after I graduated from college from Arizona State.
Mm-hmm. Roberta,
okay,
I saw a very interesting article a few days ago. A young lady that's going to join your tour coming out of Stanford tied Tiger Woods' record, I think 30 wins in her college career. I can't remember, to be honest with you, I can't remember the young lady's name, but you probably know better than I. But you got a lot of competition coming in from up under, including yourself.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are a lot of young, talented women coming up, and, you know, they're graduating from college and getting started on their professional career. And, I mean, it's just great. Women's golf is growing, and this is only like a good signal for the future and, you know, for what it's going to be of women's golf in general.
Roger?
Well, yeah, Roberta, where exactly are you from? I detect a little bit of an accent.
I'm from Italy, from Siena, in Tuscany.
Oh, in Tuscany, okay.
Yep.
And you went to Oregon State, I believe you said, right?
I went to Arizona State.
Oregon State. When did you first get interested in golf? I know you said you got your LPGA card, and are you in a tournament like every week, every couple of weeks, where people can see you around the country?
Yeah, the season usually goes about from like February or March up until October or November, so about like 9 months out of the year. And there are about 25 to 30 tournaments in the schedule. So it's not every week, but it's, you know, a few weeks in a row, 4 or 5 weeks in a row, and then we get a week off and then a few more weeks in a row. So this is mostly how the schedule goes.
Roberta, one of the biggest things is the transition is the travel and the competition week in and week out. How have you found that? Because it is a... it's a difficult grind, whether you're on the men's tour or the women's tour or whatever. You pack up, you go to the next tournament, you pack up, you go to the next tournament. It's physically demanding.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, it's a lot. And it's surely like a process that you get used to as, you know, you just spend more time on tour. You know, the first year is always an adjustment to go from amateur golf to professional golf, and then as the years go by, you just get a hold of how to organize yourself and make it as easy as possible on your body. What's the best way to travel around the country without stressing out your body too much? And, you know, so it's obviously an adjustment all the time and trying to figure out to truly, like, make the most out of, you know, your body and your prime time, and at the same time be able to have an easy travel schedule.
Frank, you got a question?
Yeah, Roberta, I understand that someone is taking full credit for your last outing. Your caddy, I understand, was so knowledgeable. And would you like to talk about that? Did she really help you out, or did you have to do it all by yourself? Now,
I mean,
remember, I'm going
you
to
know,
she's going to get it two full barrels tomorrow when I talk to her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a great week. We had a lot of fun. It was, for me, that was just a confirmation that at this time in my career, I think the best thing I could have on the bag is, you know, like a familiar face, somebody that I just want to be around for 5 hours on the golf course. And you know, sometimes that's an adjustment, too, to just figure out who you have on the bag, who's going to carry for you, right? And it was just great to have her on the bag and, you know, like, just have a good time on the course, because at the end of the day, like, if you're having fun, you're most very likely to just perform at your best. Mm-hmm. That's from my experience.
It makes it easier for you to play that way.
For a good week.
Yeah. Was that a member of the Carroll family that was the caddy by any chance?
Oh, no, no, no. This is a lady who at this point is even blushing through her glasses, I can tell right now. She's a very, very nice lady that works in the same building. But,
okay.
There's a lot of cost involved in traveling and everything else. Do you have a sponsor?
Yeah, I have a few sponsors that I've picked up along the way. I have three Italian sponsors, which for me is really good. You know, I like to be able to, you know, play golf and represent some Italian brands and some Italian companies as I'm playing golf. And then I have another sponsor that I met in a pro-am in Albany, New York. So I have some financial help for sure, but you know, it's very important to just be able to have somebody, have just sponsors that help you finance your career and your season, to just be able to invest your money in the right things to get better and improve every day.
Roberto, also tell us a little bit about the caddy relationship in terms of reading the greens, because most of the caddies that you're going to work with, very familiar with the greens that you're going to be playing on that you're not that familiar with. How much help do you get there?
You know, it's the role of a caddy is obviously a very difficult role, because if you have somebody on the bag that, you know, sees you week in and week out and is with you the whole season, he's definitely able to help you because he knows what your tendencies are and what your game is like. And even on the greens, you know, there are so many ways to read the greens depending on the speed and how you roll the putts. So it's like, it all depends really what kind of relationship you have with your caddy, if they you have trust in them also. So I think if you have a caddy that, you know, travels with you every week and knows you very well, it can help you on the greens. But otherwise, it's a little bit of a guessing game, I would say, if it's a new caddy every week.
Roger? Roberta, there used to be a couple of great women's tournaments in the Philadelphia area, one in Wilmington, one in down at Absecon in at Seaview Country Club, and Don Frank and I are very familiar with it. I attended the tournament down there at Seaview a number of times, interviewed a number of great golfers. Are you going to be in any tournaments in the Philadelphia area this season coming up in the next couple months?
Yeah, so the tournament at Seaview is next week.
No, great, great.
Yeah.
Let everyone know.
I'm into the tournament for sure. And, so that's going to happen next week, and I heard the course is great. And so it will be a good challenge for everybody.
Yeah, you're going to be playing the Bay course, I'll tell you. It's in great shape. I was down there not too long ago. And they have two courses there, one with the hotel and one with the Bay course. And I think you're going to really enjoy it. It's a very, very good shape at the moment.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Frank?
Well, Roberto, with all the travel that you have to do, do you have to make your own travel arrangements, or does your sponsor do that for you?
Yeah, I definitely make my own travel arrangements every week. And, you know, like, the schedules are very similar from year by year. So right now, you know, I have, you know, house housing set up, and, you know, I know exactly how to move around for the most part. Mm-hmm. So I do everything on my own, though. I just sit down every now and then and book a bunch of flights and rental cars.
Yeah.
The administration.
Right.
Roger?
Were you ever...
Yeah, no, go ahead, Frank.
Were you able to get a hold of any of the pros around the Sarasotas that I gave you the numbers for, or are you still waiting to hear from them?
I'm still working on that. I'm looking to have something set up by October or November. So I'm still working on that. Yeah, for sure. I just moved there, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, I did have a chance to talk with the gentleman I told you about from Founders, which is a beautiful, very, very wide.
I heard of that. Yep.
And Jimmy's going to help you out on that.
That's
awesome.
Great.
That's great. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Don, will you be at Seaview next week to see Roberta?
I don't know. I may be down there. I haven't got a schedule for next week yet, so I'll keep that in mind because I love going down there. Seaview is one of the great places in New Jersey, and the two golf courses there are one of the best. So, Roberta, maybe I'll be down here to see you play.
Awesome. Awesome. That's great.
Well, I'll tell you, when you're down there, Roberta, you may run into a good friend of ours. That's Tom Williams, been New Jersey Sportscaster of the Year so many times. He lives in Ocean City. Matter of fact, I just heard from him today, and I will be talking to him, and I'm sure he'll be over there because he does everything, and get to meet you because he's a terrific guy and a good friend of ours.
That's
and Tony,
awesome.
Tony will definitely be there because he's definitely going to be there on Sunday covering the tournament. He's a traveling golfer. He does a TV show on NBC Sports Philadelphia. And I know he'll be there, so I'll give him a call after we do the show tonight and tell him to look you up. Terrific, terrific guy. And he's now played on something like 967 different golf courses around the world. He's going to write a book when he gets to 1,000. So I'll certainly give him your name and tell him to stop in and say hello.
There you go. Please do.
Don, he's already got her name. I talked to Tony when he was teaming
up.
You talked to Tony, good. Venice the other day. Yeah.
Good.
So if you let him know that she's coming, that she's going to be there, maybe he can do an interview on Golf TV for her.
Right.
By the way, did you guys know that Tony recovered from some surgery recently?
Yeah, I had dinner with him. I had dinner with him 2 weeks ago. And, he's doing real well, and his wife is even doing better. She had some problems as well with cancer, but she's got a clean slate right now. So he's very happy about that. He got through the operation for himself in good shape. So, as I said, I had dinner with him 2 weeks ago. And Roberto, I'll definitely give him a call tomorrow morning and just reaffirm what Frank has said. Say, you know, stop by and see whether he can do a little something with you on either radio or television or at the same time, get a chance to meet you.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Frank?
Great. Roberta, I want to thank you for taking the time tonight to be with us. We really appreciate it. We would like to have you come back on the air later on.
Absolutely.
When you finish up the tour. And maybe even come on as a guest host some nights and bring some of the other golfers on with you.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it. And, yeah, anytime I'm here. And I can bring other golfers, too.
Terrific.
Great.
Wonderful.
Great.
Thanks so much. Good luck next week, Roberta.
Thank you so much.
Safe travel.
Thank you.
Great segment, Roberta. Great to talk women's golf. And we'll continue to do that during the course of the golf season and beyond. However, we're going to switch to football now. And we're in the summer football. That's the USFL, as you well know. Trevor Bosco always covers it for us. That young man has been very, very active in the USFL. So, Trevor, give us an update for this particular week as we get going.
Hold on a minute. His line was busy. I have to get him back on.
Oh, okay. Hey, Frank, we need to have updates by Mr. Henderson about, like, he didn't even tell us about Tony Leodora. I saw it on Facebook. We need updates from our leader. Holy smokes, he leaves us out in the cold here.
I got to listen. I have to take care of the guests that we have on the program. I can't just let them go by and not go by and get them some dinner and do things for them because they're nice enough to come on with us for 15, 20 minutes. Out of their busy schedule.
You're buying dinner? That'll be a first.
So I keep them in mind. And I say, when I'm going to have a chance, and I'm close, and I was drove over to Venice. My wife and I drove over to Venice and had dinner with his wife and some of the family were over there. Very, very lovely restaurant. And he was doing a little Frank Sinatra scenario over there. It was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't even tell us. I brought it up. I was shocked. I mean, nothing had been said because when I saw it on Facebook.
To be honest with you, Roger, I did not know he had had problems until I got there. He told me at the time. Hey, I had no knowledge that he had been under the weather at all.
Hey, Don.
Yeah.
Trevor's on.
Okay, Trevor, let's get to it. USFL football season in the summer. give us an update on what's going on. I know Philly's on TV on Fox this weekend, so people get a chance to see Philly. I think it's the 1 o'clock game on Friday, isn't it, Trevor? Or Saturday, isn't it, Trevor?
Looking at the schedule here, coming up, we have at 12
Double
p.m.
Doubleheader, I know that.
On Saturday, the Philadelphia Stars will be playing at 3 p.m. on NBC. And they're going to be playing the Birmingham Stallions, and that's going to be a really interesting game because they have not played each other since the championship game of the first season. So that's kind of a rivalry that's been brewing. And it's going to be a really big game on NBC this weekend. And then we have a doubleheader on Sunday, obviously. Both games will be on Fox. The interesting thing about this upcoming weekend is that there's playoff implications for a lot of these teams. If the Maulers, the Pittsburgh Maulers and New Jersey Generals lose and the Philadelphia Stars win this weekend, then they clinch a spot in the Northern Division. And then the South is still pretty much a very close neck-and-neck race. The Stallions are leading the league with their record at 5-2. And they honestly probably have some of the more premier players in the league. I think personally the MVP of this league so far is quarterback Alex Magoo for the Birmingham Stallions. He looks like Johnny Manziel of the USFL. Not the negative parts of Johnny Manziel, but his style of play. He's very agile, very versatile as a quarterback. He dances around in the backfield and just extends plays. And he doesn't make mistakes. He's leading the league in passing touchdowns with 13, in seven games. He's also the point leader in the league with 102 total points on the season scored by him, which is fairly impressive. That's a quarterback. He's also leading his team in rushing. And for a quarterback to lead a team in rushing, that is just very impressive. You can tell he's taking up a lot of the workload.
To Roger, just get an update. Mets lead the Phillies 4-1. They're playing in the bottom of the fifth inning at Citi Field in New York. Nola's still in there for the Phillies, but they're down 4-1, and they were up 1-0, and then the Mets have come on now to score four to make it 4-1. Roger, you're up.
Well, you know, Trevor, I was thinking of you today. Are you a collector of USFL memorabilia from the past? Are you really into that way?
I sadly don't have any of the really cool memorabilia or merchandise from back in the day, but I do actually own a couple of some of the new gear. I got a hoodie and a water bottle. I really do like and believe in supporting and stuff that you enjoy, and any way I can help the league by talking about it on here or on Twitter, stuff like that. I try and be very active with the information, because when it comes down to it, it'd be really nice to see a league like this actually be able to sustain itself in this time slot. And if you are a fan, or if you do have a home team in this league and you're out there listening, I definitely recommend you tune in and maybe grab yourself a hat or something, because this is something that's trying to elevate people and players and coaches and try and get them to that next level, not only with just experience, but, actual in-game experience is probably the most valuable thing you can get as a player and a coach. So I think it's important that we're getting leagues like this, more and more frequently, and, you got to support them. But I definitely do have some merchandise. I have a Tampa Bay Bandits beanie. Hopefully that team comes back next season. I definitely have a couple USFL items.
Good.
For sure.
Well,
Frank, you got a question?
I think it's going to be successful, and I will put in the mail to your grandfather. I just came across a postcard picture of the Stars championship team from back, in the day when Jim Mora was the coach and Carl Peterson was there, and I'll send it to him so he can pass it along. But on a more modern note, I agree with you. I like to see the team win the league be successful, and I think they will be.
Hey, Trevor,
and
Frank,
you got a question?
It was announced on Saturday that Vinny Papati of it, Vinny yeah, Papati, no, Papali, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And his Case Casey, is it? Is that his coach? I mean, his quarterback are spending much more time together, and certainly did show it on Saturday. Now, next week we're going to have his dad on, and if you're available, we'd like to have you come on and talk with him about Denny and his progress.
Oh, that'd be an honor to come and talk about some USFL football, and especially Vinny Papali. He's the 13th ranked receiver in this league. He's the leading receiver on the Memphis Showboats. As of right now, let me just pull up his receiving stats. He has, I think, over 273 receiving yards. I think he has 2 touchdowns on the season. And he's on a team where they do run heavy. And we've seen this in the past 4 weeks. Their team is on a 4-game win streak. They started out 0-3. Mm-hmm. They're getting in rhythm still. And I don't think we've seen them at their best yet. So mm-hmm. we'll definitely look out for Vinny Papali this weekend. But he's been probably the most sure-handed receiver in this league. Him and Bailey Gaither are up there, in my opinion. Those are guys mm-hmm. that you can just count on. But, yeah, Vinny Papali had another great game this past weekend. He had a nice touchdown. And yeah. him and Cole Kelly, that's their quarterback. They're on the same page, and you can tell. And it's definitely showing and scoring more points when they need it, because they've been, you know, not destroying teams on the scoreboard or anything. No blowout wins, but they've been winning the gritty games. So, you know, that's all you can really ask for. And they've been dominating time of possession, mainly because of their run game, but – when you have a guy like Vinny Papali on the outside, he's going to make your job a lot easier as a offensive coordinator and play caller, and especially a quarterback.
Trevor, is Birmingham still the leading contender to stay at the top?
I personally believe so, but as of right now, they're 5-2 on the season. They're undefeated at home. They're probably the most popular team in the league. They just look completely sound from offense to defense to special teams. They have Skip Holtz as their coach. His dad was very famous, obviously, Lou Holtz, Notre Dame guy. And you can see where he got his football mind from, because he runs a very, you know, tight ball club. And not only – he's not like a Bill Belichick drill sergeant kind of guy. He's very down-to-earth with his players. He likes to ask him, hey, what's working for you? What are you good at? What do you feel comfortable with? And that kind of – coaching is the reason why they've only lost 3 games in 2 years. So, I mean, he's probably going to get a call up soon, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's to a big college, you know, program, or, you know, potentially even a shot as an OC or a DC in the NFL, because he's got the talent, he's got the mind, and he's a really good leader of men. So that's something that I think will also be noticed after this year. But I do believe that they're still favored to win it all this year, yes.
Roger?
You know, I'm glad that he got a chance to get back into coaching, because his last job in college was at USF, and he had a fantastic quarterback and a good line his first 2 years. But then the quarterback got hurt, and 2 of the linemen ended up their wives getting fooling around on their wives, and the wives went to the dean and said, hey, wait a minute, we're doing all the work. We're going to class for them. We're doing everything else. So that fell apart. His whole team fell apart. And he really didn't go out of Tampa with a highly thought of rating. So I'm glad to see that he's back in, because he is a gentleman. We met him a couple times at the Bucks game and at the Outback Bowl. He was there. And I think he is, you know, in contrast to somebody he brought to one of the games, almost floored everybody when former Florida coach and Ohio State, what the hell's his name?
Murray.
Urban Myers.
Oh,
no,
Urban
Meyer. Yeah, he brought Myers to a game, and Myers was about the most aloof, nasty person you ever want to meet, but Skip was signing autographs with people, shaking hands, and really, you know, like Trevor said, he is his father's son.
Roger?
Well, I'm going to go over the schedule, Trevor. As I see it, there's like 4 games on Saturday. because you've got Houston, or I'm sorry, or it's USA, Houston, Pittsburgh. That's at noon on USA Network. And then on Peacock, which people have trouble getting, including me, the Stars and the Stallions. And I think the NFL made a disastrous move by putting a playoff game on Peacock that hardly anybody will get. And then on Sunday at 1 o'clock, you got Memphis and New Jersey at 1 on Fox. And then at 4 o'clock on Sunday, you have Michigan and New Orleans. Am I correct about that, Trevor?
Yes. The interesting thing about the Peacock exclusive games that are going to be coming into the NFL and stuff, during the USFL, it looks like you can only see it on Peacock, but I assure you it will be on NBC at 3 p.m. Peacock is just like a streaming service that they do through NBC, obviously, but, you know, just to make it seem a little more exclusive. But that game will be on NBC. I have noticed that, you know, if it says Peacock on the schedule, it's also going to be on NBC as well. So they are still getting on that major network. And I would like to just briefly talk about Week 7's ratings. They looked a little rough because of the point you just made, is that they're on USA, or, you know, they're going to be on Peacock exclusively, or FS1. Those are really small networks, and they don't average a lot of viewers. So I'm glad to see them on three major networks. Well, at least three of the games are on a major network this weekend. But USA is terrible. It is one of the worst networks that they could have chosen. Maybe they got some kind of deal with them, but it's not the production.
It's owned
that
by
about
NBC.
It.
It's owned by NBC, right?
I believe so. It's like one, it's like an FS1 to NBC in a sense. But it's really bad. Not in terms of production or anything. It just averages maybe 250,000 viewers a weekend, which is not what you want at all.
Well, the Peacock,
well, I gotta say, just the opposite
NFL
for Fox.
Playoffs,
I think Fox has done a pretty good
Peacock
job of
and that's
of
a real problem.
The league.
Don, let me just say this, just to follow up with Trevor. That NFL playoff game is only Peacock. And that's what is really causing an uproar. And you know, I understand it can be Peacock and NBC, but they're not showing that it's NBC. And that's going to turn people off because they won't even attempt to look at the game unless, you know, on NBC if they don't see it's only on Peacock. That's poor marketing. That's all I can say.
Roger, they're trying to force betting. Don't you understand it? They're trying to force you to the channel. First of all, you got to buy the channel. Secondly, the betting is so heavy now on football that they think the betting will create an audience. And, you know, I wouldn't buy it. I don't care if they give it to me for free. I'm not watching it. So it doesn't make any difference to me. The more secondary channels they go to for baseball, football, same thing with Thursday night in the NFL, going to rotate now, going to be able to shuffle games. Guys that wants to go to a game at the say a guy have Eagle tickets to go at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and they're going to shuffle the Thursday night game, so it's going to be on at 8 o'clock at night instead of 1 o'clock in the AM. I'm not watching it. Period. That's ending report. That's it.
You.
Trevor, it's up to you.
I just wanted to quickly say I do agree with you that NBC has done a really good job in its own. They averaged the most viewers in week four with over 2 million, but you know, USA, I know it's a part of NBC. It's just not pulling people at all. But in the grand scheme of things, that's sadly where professional sports are going to these. They're just selling out time slots to these streaming platforms. I know Peacock will not be the only platform this year getting an NFL game. I know YouTube will also be getting a time slot, I believe. So there's going to be even more spread out.
By next year, they're going to solidify maybe one.
The USFL, I would like to see
to get every game. Don't you think they're going to do that?
I personally am not a fan of it. But if the USFL is doing this merely, you know, for the fact that they're getting contract money from these other channel networks and stuff, I can see why a smaller league would need to spread out like that. But the NFL or like MLB, it's just getting to the point where like they just want more money and they're going to get it somehow, I feel. So it sucks for the average viewer, but, you know, what it's kind of turning into, and no one's really kind of making a stance on that. So at least no one that has, you know, the power to actually, you know, keep things in a relatively simple manner to where you get major networks that are covering these games, because the major networks typically have the better production value, and they typically, you know, just look and sound and are better in general, rather than watching a NFL game on USA. You know, it's just a whole different energy and vibe, and you're not going to pull as many viewers. But, you know, the NFL doesn't really worry about viewers anymore, so I don't really think they care. I mean, they're so popular to the point where, you know, if you don't like it, you know, there's going to be five other fans that are just going to, you know, buy that subscription fee for Peacock to watch the game. It's the sad reality of, I guess, this kind of, you know, marketing, but also just how aggressive these leagues have to become when they become Goliaths. They just have to keep getting more and more and more. So I really
it's
hope
all
it doesn't
about the
paint
dollar.
These new leagues.
That's what it is.
Yeah,
all about the dollars. Trevor, thank you very, very much for another good segment
on
the
show. Have a great week, Trevor.
We'll talk
thank
to you next week again about the USFL, and we'll also have a chance to talk to Vince Papale, and he'll give us a little information, as you will, on his son and how he's doing down there. So thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Take
Mike
care. You
Simsack
too,
is with us right now. And, Blake, you got a new hockey coach down there in the nation's capital.
I don't think we have a new hockey coach. I do think we have a new GM.
Oh, it's GM? I thought it was a hockey coach.
Yeah, I don't think we have a coach yet. I think we have a GM. We have a GM of the basketball. We have a president of basketball operations, too. But a
lot going on.
You know, and that got lost in the wash. Gentlemen, I need to start with this. So two big things with the Washington football team that happened over the last week. A, the league sent Josh Harris's bid back because they did not like the finances and the number of minority owners.
Okay.
So,
you had mentioned that last week, Mike. You really, really expounded on the fact you thought it was going to be difficult because of that particular point. You were certainly right on target.
Yeah, so I had heard it was 17 minority owners. The one that came out from the league put it north of 20. And they were just not comfortable with how this was set up. I still think that the original structure of the deal is going to be very similar, with the Harris Group owning about 30 to 35%, Mitch Rales owning about 15%, Max Johnson in between 3 and 5%, and then filling out the rest with minority owners, all of whom are going to own about 1% or 2%. The NFL really did not like how this deal was structured. The problem is NFL Josh Harris did exactly what the NFL bylaws said. You have to own at least 30% of a team to be considered the primary owner and operator. He said, I can get 30%, and then I'll use somebody else's money for the other 70. And he went out and he got a bunch of minority owners to all put in the money so that he could get the bid together. The problem is, as long as my math is still mathing, 30 ain't 50. And somehow he has the ability under the NFL's bylaws to only own 30% of the team, but the other 70% does not have a controlling interest. Doesn't necessarily work in my math, but maybe y'all have a different take on that and figure out how that math maps.
Well,
Roger?
Mike, a couple of things about that. From what Howard Eskin reported, I think it was Saturday, a lot of that 30% is credit that Josh Harris got. okay? I don't know if you know anything about that. That's number one.
There's apparently about $1 billion in unsecured debt or unsecured credit that would be part of that bid. That's what's really making the NFL nervous.
Right. And then on top of that, there's a report that the Commanders or the Washington football team, somebody has a copyright on the Commanders, and it's not the Washington football team. And is it, did you hear the story? They're going to have to pay somebody, or they're going to have to get the name, or they're going to have to change the name?
Roger and Mike, I think that came up, Mike, didn't it, before they actually made the announcement? Like, it was announced a week ahead of time. Not announced, but it was leaked a week ahead of time. And at that time, they said that was not a legitimate name that they could use because somebody else had a patent for it. Is that correct?
All right. Y'all are getting into a different issue other than the sale, which is something I was going to get on to next. Yes.
Yeah.
Roger, you're 100% correct. The number of minority owners and the $1 billion in unsecured debt that Josh Harris had is what's making the NFL a little bit nervous, which is why they initially pushed back and sent that back and told him he needs to come up with slightly different finance. Now we get into the trademark, the copyright on the name, which was initially rejected by the U.S. Patent Office. There is a guy in Virginia who bought up when the Commanders said that when the Redskins said that they were going to change their name, bought up every conceivable domain that he could think of for possible names that they could change it to, and therefore does right now own a copyright on Washington Commanders. There's also a high school military football game, a high school or small military college football game that involves Commanders Bowl that was put up as a challenge to the Commanders trademark. To be honest, in the course of everything that's going on, because also understand that the Commanders was a team, was a name used by a, and we just talked about the USFL, like a USFL or AFL, one of those leagues that went out of business right around COVID, the San Antonio Commanders was a name used at that point, so there's also that floating out. Pantheon that they have to deal with, these are very, very small things.
Right.
It sounds bigger than it really is. It requires them to give a response, A, to say that this, like, high school, junior, college football game is not going to impact name recognition. Like, nobody is going to mistake the Washington Commanders NFL football team for this game that apparently nobody knew existed until this week. They can talk to the guy in Virginia who said he held them. He seems like a guy you can give, like, season tickets to, and he'll be cool. They can take care of him. And the San Antonio thing is debunked. So it's a couple of questions that they need to answer, and they should be good. Everything that I understand, it sounds a lot worse than it really is. You know, I was telling everybody, because there was a couple of days where it sounded like Christmas down here. The Redskins going to be sold. There's a possibility that they may end up back at RFK. That's still in existence. And we're going to be able to get rid of the Commanders' name because they failed to trademark. Two of those are accurate, right? They are being sold. There is still a chance that they may end up back at the RFK site. You are going to be stuck with the Commanders for at least the next 4 years because NFL rules dictate anytime you make a massive trademark shift, you have to do it for 5 years.
Okay.
Complications. Complications.
Oh,
there,
it's one thing after another, and the other thing is that when you talk about trademarks, wasn't it Rick Pitino that trademarked three-peat and nobody could
use three-peat?
Pat Riley, that's what it was, Pat Riley, and he was the one that got the trademark on three-peat, and everybody had to buy it from him when he was coaching.
And, Anthony Davis apparently has a trademark on unibrow. Well, you can get a trademark on a lot of things, and it just requires the next guy to negotiate with you for a couple of bucks.
Sure. Or $1 million, whatever the case
Roger,
might be.
Roger, go back to what you said when we were talking about the USFL, the TV, money. Everybody has to pay for something. They can't wait to get an oar in the water so they get more money.
Exactly. I mean, this Washington situation is unbelievable. When you look at how this franchise in every way, business, field, every way imaginable has deteriorated so fast and so bad.
Roger was one of the premier franchises in all of sports.
Oh, John, it was unbelievable. I mean, I can remember I was on doing my 2 weeks of training duty, and I was stationed in the barracks at Fort Myer. Mike, you're very familiar with it, train barracks at Fort Myer. And I was laying in the bunk at night, and the bulletin came on. Allen was let go, was fired as coach of the Redskins. I mean to tell you, I mean what a deal! And we go back to Ken Beatrice at WMAL and the shows he did, and it was Frank Herzog, Sam Huff, Sonny Jurgensen, what a broadcast crew. And now it's down in the dumpers, the whole operation is sad.
Roger, I was not going to tell this tonight, but you brought up Washington and Fort Myers, which is,
yeah,
to use the parlance of our time, it's triggering me a little bit. Gentlemen, I'm going to tell you a story, and you can believe me or you can believe me not.
We believe you, Mike. You're our authority.
Right.
You know that my wife works for the government. She's recently begun a job over at Walter Reed, where one of her things is to work with facility dogs. They have dogs that are specially trained to deal with our service members in the hospital over at Walter Reed. Now, the dogs have service rights. One of the dogs is getting promoted tomorrow to master sergeant.
I love it.
I myself topped out as an E6. But the dog is getting promoted to master sergeant. I kid you not.
Give me one or two quick words on the U.S. 20-and-under soccer team, because they're undefeated right now and coming together. Give us some thoughts on that.
But
hey, your bailiwick.
Roger and Don, she had said an E3 to drive her out to Fort Myers to pick up Master Sergeant rank for the dog.
I love it. It's great.
You can't make this stuff up.
My brother was in the Presidential Honor Guard out there, so I've been there. I've been there many times.
Mike, I got a question for you.
Yes.
The former union coach, assistant coach,
EJ Callahan.
Bill Cobb, EJ Callahan. Yeah. But Frank, I'm sorry, I missed that. He's not. When you said coach, I thought he was the guy who actually coached the team. He was an assistant.
Yeah.
So yeah,
right.
The U.S. men's national team is on their third manager in less than 6 months. They did not retain Greg Berhalter after the World Cup. Anthony Hudson took over. But they told Anthony Hudson that he was not likely to get the job full-time. So he said, I'm going to take the job full-time. And so now they hired the third assistant, B.J. Callahan, who used to be an assistant youth team coach with the Philadelphia Union, who is now the senior men's national coach for the U.S. men's national team. If you want to talk about failing up, please give me a better definition than this.
Roger, we'll let you pick up the next one.
I want to say that I know exactly what you're talking about the rank, Mike, because I was at Fort Meade doing training duty one time, and I was in E6, and it took me a while to make E6, and yet they were bringing in APGs, you know what that is, advanced patriots,
yep.
Civilians that never spent a day in military training in their life. But they were working at NSA, and that's what was causing the backlog on why guys in my category, as cryptologic technicians, couldn't get advanced. I mean, it's ridiculous, some of the things that go on, but you and I understand that. And Don's right. It's the old guard is the
I got to react to the fact that I'm outranked by a dog.
Me too.
There's
I have two.
Well, if you had to go on to Villanova, Mike, you might have been okay. When they found out you went to Villanova, they put the dog over you.
Yeah, the dog outranked me. And somebody had to drive my wife to pick up rank for the dog's promotion ceremony. Oh, and the dog needs cake.
Sorry for the talk. I've got bronchitis.
Go ahead, Roger.
No, I was just going to say I apologize. I try to cut that muted the cough, but when I start laughing, I've got bronchitis, so I'm taking meds. But, I know what you mean, Mike. And, it'll be interesting to follow where the stadium will finally be built it's just sad. I mean, the whole situation, I don't know what else to say.
Listen, I'm still a believer in the old RFK Stadium site because it's right downtown. I mean, if they get access in and out and parking, they could build a terrific stadium right there, I think.
Well, you
Don
and I got
and
in and
Roger,
out of there
you
easily that night,
know?
Don. There's no doubt about that.
But y'all gentlemen, you actually know it's still there.
The stadium's still there.
The stadium is actually still there. Had driven down by that area about 3 weeks ago. And it's the first time I've been down in that area in a little bit. And I thought, okay, it's not going to still be there. And as we're driving down 295, I look up. It's still there. Still have not been able to tear it down. Even the
that's
final.
Well, it wasn't in very good shape. Roger, we were
started.
There last, so I can imagine what it's like now. But, I mean, they're going to have to tear it down, build a new stadium. But, I mean, it's a site. I mean, the throughway goes right next to it. I mean, all you got to find is parking, and they got plenty of neighborhoods that they can rearrange down there without hurting anybody. And put a heck of a stadium right downtown, I think.
Oh, it'll be a great location, but I promise you, like, RFK's like a cockroach. Remember when they tried to demolish the Spectrum?
Sure, maybe, right. Maybe, Mike, you'll have an answer for us as to what they're going to do. Thanks, always. Your segment always is interesting and informative.
Mike, have a great week.
You too. Talk to you later. Peace.
Doug Hamilton standing by right now. He's in the batter's circle, and looking forward to being on the program this evening. His Orioles did not have a good day today. PGA professional, he talks about all the golf information that you ever want to know. But we're going to start off with those Orioles who had the tough day, but they're still in second place unless the Yankees win tonight. What do you got, Doug?
It's been, you know, they've lost two consecutive series, and, you know, it's painful to lose at home against the Cleveland Indians team that had, I don't know, 22 wins or whatever it was, 24 wins. They haven't looked good. You know, I think, you know, their bullpen's been pretty taxed. They haven't pitched particularly well. I mean, they got off to a fairly good start today. I mean, I was listening to them for a little bit, and early on, I think they were up 3-1, and gosh, every time I looked at my phone, they were losing. I don't know what happened today. They're taking a little road trip here to San Francisco, you know, and then they're going to visit Milwaukee for a couple days. So, I mean, they've got a lot of tough baseball games up, and, you know, Cedric Mullins getting hurt certainly didn't help.
No.
You know, there's pieces to that team. You know, I mean, there's a lot of good pieces to that team, but there's also, I mean, I'm not a Taron Vavra fan. Brian McKenna's kind of okay to me. I mean, they just signed Aaron Hicks, which I think is stopgap kind of just to put a body there, which doesn't impress me. Michael Givens out of the bullpen looks awful. I don't know why he's on the roster. He looks like he's gained 20 or 30 pounds since I last saw him, and he throws, you know, kind of little frisbees in there about 89, 90 miles an hour.
Let me interrupt for a second. I don't think the Hicks move is a bad move. I mean, he was starting to hit a little bit with the Yankees before they finally decided to eat that $30 million. I mean, I don't know how you eat $30 million, but
right.
Cashman can do it season after season. But I don't think he's a bad pickup.
I think that the concept moving forward was that he's going to be more serviceable than Ryan McKenna is as their fourth outfielder. When Cedric Mullins comes back. But, you know, for me and Don, we've talked about this pipeline of prospects that the Orioles have. You know, I'd rather see them pick up a guy from their AAA team, Colton Cowser, Jordan Westberg, or somebody like that who's, you know, nearly ready to step into a major league role and see, you know, if they're ready to do that as opposed to taking, you know, you're signing these people perform for you, but at the same time they're taking away at bats from somebody you need to see develop, and
right.
I feel like that's the wrong direction for them to go. And you know, they've looked good at times. The month of April, you know, was certainly a good month for them. You know, May was kind of okay for them, and you know, the schedule is going to continue to show its teeth as they move forward, and I don't know that they have all the pieces they need. But again, I don't, you know, we've talked about this in different segments, but I don't know what their expectations are from a front office standpoint. Are they attempting to make the playoffs, or are they trying to have a better record than they had last year? Are they trying to, you know, because there's guys at the AA level that are ready to take the jump to AAA, which means what? There's AAA guys that need to make the jump to Major League. So, you know, if they're using this timeline to figure out who's going to be a part of their future, well, some of the guys I just named aren't part of that. You know, so I'm
Roger.
Not sure what we're doing with this.
Hey, Doug, how much did it cost the Orioles to get Hicks, you know?
Well, as Don mentioned, I mean, he had signed a sizable contract with the Yankees. I believe it was in the neighborhood of $70 million. And I think they wound up eating the remaining portion of, which he noted was around $30 million. So I don't know if they signed him to, like, a major league minimum concept, or, you know, whatever.
I would say that's
similar.
Exactly what they did. He had $30 million still coming from the Yankees, and I believe, I didn't see the numbers, but normally when you get a player that's passed through waivers and has been released by a team, you sign him for the major league minimum, and I think that's probably what they did.
Yeah.
With
more than likely.
Seniority. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, what I'm looking at is I think the Yankees made a big mistake to sign him for that contract.
Oh,
because
right.
if you look
and
at
played
his history,
2 years.
Well, he was hitting 230. His average is 230 for his career. He's a 211 this year, 216 last year, 194 in 21, 25, 225, but that was that shortened season.
But he's hurt all the time. That's the problem. He didn't play very many games last year. And he also they switched him from center to left field, which was not good. He didn't make the accommodation as well as they had hoped. And so he really didn't become the sixth outfielder. They wanted to do exactly what Doug is saying with the Orioles. The Yankees mm-hmm. wanted to bring up younger players and give them the opportunity to play and cut Hicks, even though it was a $30 million cut. But it's basically right. exactly what you're saying, Doug.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the Yankees have proven over the course of time to frivolously spend money. And, you know, when I watched opening day in the series that the Orioles played with the Yankees and then subsequently when they went to New York, you know, I mean, the Yankees have Aaron Judge. You know, I mean, he's obviously an MVP contender. But if you look at across the rest of their lineup, there's really nothing that impresses me about their offense other than him and maybe the ability of Stanton to swat, you know, 20 or 30
yeah, Rizzo,
home runs.
Rizzo's a big-time player.
Rizzo's a good player, you're right. But, I mean, from top to bottom, I mean, you know, for all the money they've spent on their payroll, that offense doesn't impress me. I mean, they have probably the second or third best bullpen in Major League Baseball, and then you throw in, you know, Cortez, and you throw in Gerrit Cole, and you've got a pretty good pitching staff. I mean, but you take away Aaron Judge for an extended period of time, and that Yankees lineup is going to struggle immensely. So, you know, when I look at the Orioles and I say, okay, well, you know, offensively, I like, you know, kind of what they're doing from top to bottom and guys that can shift around and play different positions. And, you know, their bullpen is a good one, but it's, you know, it's ranked maybe a tier or two lower than what that, you know, Yankees bullpen is. It's the starting pitching, you know, and I've hammered this concept home in every segment we've talked about the Orioles, that it's just not sustainable for them to keep running the same guys out there and expecting them to perform. You know, Kyle Gibson's 7-3. Where did that come from, right? But he's, you know, I mean, he's, you know, there's nothing impressive to me about his starts, you know, and Dean Kramer and Wells and all these guys. I mean, they can mix and match and throw a couple good starts, and then all of a sudden they get bombed and don't make it out of the first or second inning. So, you know, as you mentioned, Don, that guy that you can hand the baseball to every fourth or fifth day and they're going to stop a losing streak isn't on their team. So, I mean, I'm not sure what that looks like in another 110 games, you know.
Roger?
Well, they still got a 14-point lead. They're only four games behind Tampa Bay. And if we talked about it earlier, Doug, when you look at the Central, there's Minnesota 28-27, only one over 500. You look at the West, Texas 35-20, Houston 32-22, and then the Angels 30-27. And then you go to the National League. The Phillies are looking awful. The Braves are the cream of the crop, 33-23. Miami's only two over 500. Milwaukee's only two over 500. The Dodgers are 11 over. And Arizona is 9 over. What does that say? I think it tells me the Orioles are a pretty good team, and no matter what, they're 5-5 in the last 10. They lost one, but they're still a team to be reckoned with, and they're good.
Totally agree. And what I'll tell you is, you know, the American League East is very good. I mean, if you take the last place team in the American League East, which is the Red Sox, they would be first place in like two or three other divisions. You know,
right.
So the,
exactly.
That concept of, you know, the more balanced schedule so that you don't have to play against your rivals, your foes 19 times a year, whatever it is, that's we talked about that as a real big key and plus for the Orioles to not get beat up in their own division so that they can
absolutely.
You know, and I think that's going to play a key role, I think, in what happens come playoff time.
Let's get to your bailiwick, the Memorial. Big Jack Nicklaus, this tournament, some of your thoughts about, I've never, to be honest with you, I've never seen that golf course. I've never been out there. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have. Give us an idea of what you think about the Memorial.
No, I've never been out there. There was a point in time where we had a member who would bring a guest to our member guest, you know, each June when we had it, who was a member out there, Mirrorfield Village. But, you know, just from watching it on TV, I mean, over the years, it's one hell of a hard golf course to play. And, you know, I have some fond memories of, you know, Tiger Woods winning that event, and obviously Jack Nicklaus being the host is always a pretty big deal there, as was, you know, Arnold Palmer when he was the host at the Bay Hill Classic or whatever. Look, these guys play long golf courses in week in and week out. I mean, you know, to the average golfer, watching this on TV, and, you know, we talked about this at the PGA Championship with Oak Hill and how, you know, not only the weather conditions, but just the overall length of that golf course and you know, some of those shots those guys have to hit are so impressive. So it's every week, I mean, it's a true test of not just field and the ability levels of, but also, you know, the course and the conditions and all those sorts of things. I mean, that's good stuff.
Roger.
Hey, Doug, we had I don't know if you heard the show earlier, she was terrific, an LPGA member who was going to be playing at Seaview next weekend, or next week, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get out to see any ladies' tournaments at all?
Seaview, that's what, Atlantic City?
Seaview's Atlantic City.
That's a good venue. You know, we played there was a course I played up there called Galloway, which is a national course. Very challenging.
There.
Nice place.
Don's a member there.
Is he? Wow. He must be making the big bucks to be a member there, huh?
Well, we know that. Don, Frank,
yeah.
You know, I know that. I mean, but go ahead.
You know,
I want to
Doug,
find
there's
out
one thing you should
follow.
Do is listen only with one ear. To hear some of these statements made by Frank and by Roger, because there's a lot of things they don't know anything
about. And Bill Wernthal. You got to include Bill Wernthal in that.
If I were a member of Seaview, I'd be in Roger's class, but I am not of Seaview. But I would like to go next weekend to see the ladies down there. I agree with it. They play on the Bay course. I love it. I'd love to get down to see it if I can. But I'll tell you, the women's tour is trying very, very hard to be competitive and get more and more youngsters in. As I said to the young lady when she was on with us in the second segment of the show, Berta, who came over from Italy and is playing now, I guess, in second or third tournament, it's great to see the depth of the women's tournament growing, too. And had this young lady from Stanford. I just didn't know, remember her name. I read about
Oregon
it this week.
State.
No, she's from Oregon State, but the girl that's coming on this week who won the 30 tournaments to match Tiger, Tiger had the record at Stanford with 30 wins. This young lady matched his record at Stanford with 30 wins, and she's going into the LPGA this week, I think, will be her first tournament.
Yeah, I mean, it's impressive on any level. You know, if you get the opportunity to watch, whether it's, you know, the ladies or the men's or the seniors or whatever, you know, the golf ball doesn't know who's hitting it, you know, so that's devoid of, you know, sex or race or any of those sorts of things. And if you get the opportunity to watch any of those, I mean, we've had, you know, for me in the Maryland area, I mean, they used to go to Bully Rock and they would do the McDonald's. And that was also a concept of a pro-am type of thing where they would get some local PGA professionals to fill out some of their early week kind of fields. You know, they were at Cave Sally for some different things that they had done there. That was kind of that international cup or whatever it was, I think, at one point. You know, Seaview, Atlantic City, I mean, hell, that's not terribly far from where I am. But there's different places that you can go to watch these things. I mean, I've been to my fair share of some of these different events, whether it be seniors or whatever locally, but I've never actually seen the women play. You know, but I think it would be fun to watch them. I mean, they're equally as impressive in their own rights when it comes to, you know, ball striking and abilities. I mean, I've watched different things on TV with some of the, you know, playing lessons and stuff like that on the Golf Channel, which is superb, and what's kind of going through their mind and the shots they hit and what they're trying to do. I mean, you can always, you know, take something away from, you know, that. And I always encourage people when they watch tour events like that, you know, go to the driving range, go to the putting green, watch them practice. I mean, the on-course stuff is all well and good to stand on a hole and watch people come through and see the different players, and I get that. But if you truly want to learn something and kind of be a student of the game, go to those areas and watch how methodical they are. Watch how they practice. Watch their routines. You know, watch their interactions with their caddies. You know, all those things are really, really cool to see.
Doug,
Roger?
Let me say this about golf. I've been subbed at the middle school here for just about every day this past year. And what's really
get it in quickly. We only got a second, Roger.
Yeah. I was just going to say they even had a golf team in middle school. Where my kids, they didn't even have middle school sports in Hamilton until years later. I think that it just goes to show you about the South, and it's no wonder you get so many great players in every sport when they offer different sports. No doubt about it.
Doug, thank you very much. As always, the clock is always against us at the end. Got a lot of stuff next week to talk about, so thank you very much once again. We'll do it all again this week.
Have a great week, Doug.
We'll draw back to our Commander-in-Chief, Frank Carroll. Finish out the show.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation for the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, the men and women of Police and Fire Services, the doctors and nurses at the hospital, and the first responders. These programs are also dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty, Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcat, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Henler, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Charles Levake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Anafa Christman, Lakeland PD, Lieutenant Joe Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Arthur Pope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Chelsea Richard, Florida Highway Patrol, Chief Al Hogle, Longboat Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Blaine Lane, Polk County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Chris Meyer, Polk County Sheriff's Department, and Sergeant Christopher Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Sheriff's Office, and Temple University Police Department. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the roads rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields, the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the palm of his hand. Night, God bless, and have a great week. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 has responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Bob, we love you and we miss you.